Hello and welcome to this month's session of CIO Live. My name is Kiran Ganesh, I'm Global Head of Investor Communication. We've seen that markets have been somewhat range-bound over the past month or two, but there's certainly no lack of issues for us to focus on today. The second quarter of earnings season is underway, tech stock volatility is on the rise, and the conflict between US and Iran seems to have reignited in recent days. So to help unpack some of this, what it all means and what you need to do now, I'm pleased to be joined by Tilman Cole, who's emerging market strategist based in Dubai. And in New York, we're joined by Nadia Lavelle, who's head of global equity strategy and management, and Jason Dreho, who is head of asset allocation for the CIO in the Americas. So as we go along, please do send in any questions that you have in the little box that's on the screen there, and we'll aim to answer as many as we can towards the end of the session. Till, we're going to start with you and the latest developments between the US and Iran. Maybe you can just start by letting us know how you're assessing the situation right now.
Yeah, thank you. We are definitely in a very tense situation at the moment. The negotiations broke down over the question who controls the Strait of Hormuz and to which extent Iran started to target ships that were using the shipping lane close to the coast of Oman to impose this control. And that has escalated in the past 2 weeks to by now regular strikes by Iran on ships on military bases of the US in the region, and the US hitting back at Iranian military assets and dual use assets. The Strait of Hormuz is blocked again, so there is only a trickle of ships now passing through. And the US also reinstated the blockade of the Iranian ports. Now, these kind of escalation, military escalation, can be tactics to gain leverage at a point where negotiations were deadlocked. It can also be seen as signaling. So if you look at the strikes of Iran against the Kuwaiti power plant, desalination plant, that is a stark warning. If you target our infrastructure, we will target yours and that of your allies. But of course, these kind of tactics carry the risk of miscalculation, of unintended consequences that could lead back to the more full-scale kind of war that we have seen in spring. There have been reports in the past couple of days that mediation efforts are ongoing, but at this point, at least, it doesn't look like that this is going to have an immediate de-escalatory impact on both sides. Also important, I think, to highlight is that it's not only the US and Iran that are important actors in the region. If you look, for example, at the hostilities exchanged between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, this is concerning as well. The Houthis are threatening the shipping through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and with that, the Red Sea shipping lane. So again, taking all together, it is a very tense situation and, of course, also carries the risk of further escalation.
Yeah, thanks, Till. Certainly a lot happening. How are you framing out the different scenarios in terms of how this could end up as we look forward?
So when speaking about scenarios, I think it's important to also think first about what are the objectives, what are the limitations of the actors. If we look at the US, the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz is crucial, of course. The questions on the Iranian nuclear program are important as well, but likely less urgent at this point. The limitations, it is an unpopular war, it's a costly war, the Pentagon is asking for more funds, the gas prices have been higher and are rising again. And also, when you think about the first phase of the war, opening the Strait of Hormuz by purely an air campaign hasn't been successful, and Iran has shown that even when attacked and under pressure, it is still able to target sensitive targets like ships and installations. So unclear that an aerial campaign on its own would be able to change something about the situation in the Strait. For Iran, the pressure points are certainly of economic nature. The economy was anyway already very weak, and without the access to imports through the port system, vital goods are missing. Iran is looking for economic relief that was visible in many points in the memorandum of understanding, but Iran is also looking to retain control of this trade as a form of leverage. Here, I think important to note as well that this leverage over time is decreasing. And if there are no ships passing through the strait, then this is just that much more incentive to regional countries to find alternative ways and routes to get hydrocarbons to markets. So what does it mean in terms of the scenarios? The first one, our base case, would be that we see the hostilities continue for now. That can include that oil prices are spiking even higher than the roughly $90 per barrel that we have at the moment. But that over time, it becomes once again clear that just by pure military means, you are unable to break the deadlock, that the economic pressures are increasing again and risks around the economic impact are increasing again, and that both sides see actually a better outcome if you go back to a diplomatic framework that at least tries to manage the instability between the two. That would include a renewed pickup in the flows through the strait that should allow then oil prices to go to levels around the 85-80 range over time. Important, of course, this is unlikely to be a smooth process. The downside scenario, the risk scenario, would be where we see continued escalation in the fighting, where we see the flows through the strait not disrupted for weeks, but rather quarters, where we see potential additional damage to energy infrastructure in the region. And with that, also energy prices spiking much higher, even higher than what we've seen in spring, levels of $150 plus can't be excluded. Before then, demand destruction would set in and oil prices would come down again.
Thank you, Till. So I think that was really useful to sketch out those scenarios. I guess as we go through the next few weeks, are there some particular signposts or catalysts or things to watch to help us judge where we're heading?
Purely on the military side, the kind of quality of strikes, or if there is a balance between strikes and counter-strikes, if they are proportionate, I think is important to monitor. So whether this is more or less aligned, or if you see clear signs that you go up the escalatory ladder, the capabilities that the US is moving to the region can be one indicator for that. And then also important to see whether there are other participants starting to get involved again into the conflict. The more participants, the more parties involved, the more difficult it will also be to get back to the negotiation table. In terms of the pressure points and potential to go back to diplomatic phases is on the Iranian side, even if information there is not really flowing that easily. What kind of state is the Iranian economy in? How much support does the Iranian regime still have? More on the global side, what is the level of oil prices? How quickly are they rising? The level of product prices, so crude, not only crude oil, but also energy products. What is the impact on inflation? What's the impact on economic activity? And then, of course, also what kind of buzz is there around the mediation efforts? Are they picking up? Is there a bigger push towards that? I think perhaps as a final point, it's important to see that these geopolitical dynamics can change very quickly. If we think about the first phase of the war towards the memorandum of understanding and how quickly markets can also shift the pricing there, this can swing pretty quickly. So it is important in our view not to make big strategic decisions on portfolios just purely based on the geopolitics, but instead also have in mind what kind of macroeconomic backdrop do we have, what are the earnings trends, what are structural thematic drivers that are impacting markets, and then look at portfolios, how to make them more robust against the geopolitical risks.
Brilliant. Thank you, Till. That's great to, I guess, wrap up on some of the kind of key points from an investment perspective at the end there. Nadia, let's turn over to you now. Obviously, a lot happening in the Middle East, but there's, you know, even more happening in the world of equities. So, you know, broadly, how are you thinking about the backdrop for stocks right now?
Well, Karen, it's never a dull time in global equity markets. And I think as you alluded to at the top of the call, you know, we would describe the backdrop currently for equities as pretty constructive, but it's also more demanding than it was, I would say, at the start of the year. But I think what's important to highlight is that the rally that we've been seeing has truly been supported by really strong fundamentals. It's not just optimism. It's not a valuation multiple expansion driven story at all. It's truly an earnings growth, a strong earnings growth story. I mean, just to put some numbers around it, for instance, in the US, we are looking for 20% EPS growth for this year. And in Asia ex Japan, over 70%. And those might seem like large numbers because you normally don't see those numbers outside of our earnings recovery, but those numbers might end up be proved to be even more conservative just given the momentum that we're seeing, particularly on the AI side. And now we have the potential for a cyclical uptick as we're seeing improvements in PMIs around the world. And when you look at the economic activity, it's been quite resilient. I mean, U.S. economic growth has continued to surprise to the upside, you know, trending above 2%. And then you have the AI-related investment that really continues to support that profit growth. So with that solid underpinning, we do think that global stocks can move higher over the near term, over the medium term. I mean, we're looking for global equities to be up over 10%. Into June of next year, with particular strength we're seeing in the US as well as in Asia. But I would say, you know, I think the easy part of the rally is behind us. You know, investors are more focused on quality and durability of earnings. And that means that stock selection and portfolio construction will matter more than they did, say, in the earlier part of the cycle, Karen. You know, we're moving from a market where that broad exposure to the largest winners works very well to one more so where investors need to be a bit more deliberate about what they own, not only, but also why they own it. So, Karen, we think that the good news, though, is that the earnings story, it's broadening out. You know, AI infrastructure, of course, remains a key driver. We've been underscoring that for quite some time now, especially in the semiconductors and the broader hardware supply chain. But we're also seeing that support coming from areas like financials, you know, which is reported earnings ongoing right now in the U.S., industrials, consumer discretionary, healthcare, and, you know, markets outside the U.S. That broadening is really important because it makes the market less dependent on in sort of one narrow group of companies. And I think also what it does, it really creates that broader opportunity set for clients, which is wonderful. You know, you don't longer become overly concentrated in just a handful of stock. You're seeing that broader participation. And so our main message for equities from here is really you stay invested, but you upgrade the quality of that exposure. You're diversifying across regions, across sectors, across styles, and across those structural opportunities. And then you're also using that volatility because, you know, as Tillman talked about earlier, we are seeing a bit of pickup in volatility around geopolitical. Use that to add areas where you're seeing, you know, earnings visibility is really strong. And then for clients who have concentrated portfolios, this is an important moment. I mean, it's truly an opportunistic moment, I would say, to rebalance. You do not need to abandon the areas that have worked, right? But you do need to make sure that the portfolio is not dependent on any one narrow trade continuing to work indefinitely. Because Karen, we know, history tells us that usually is not the case. One thing does not work indefinitely. And so that rebalancing and diversification is quite important.
Thank you, Nadia. And it's definitely really encouraging to hear about the broadening in earnings growth and the broadening in the opportunity set. I mean, I think just zooming in on AI, because it is obviously still, you know, an important driver, if not the only one. And we know a lot of clients are focused on that area. How are you thinking about the sustainability of this extraordinary level of earnings growth we're seeing in that space at the moment?
And that is definitely the case, Karen. I mean, we still see AI as a powerful structural investment opportunity. I think demand is still quite strong. And, you know, many parts of the value chain, supply is still quite constrained. I mean, you're seeing that constraint in compute memory and power, in data center, you know, in networking, in advanced semiconductor manufacturing, all of those areas, that's where demand continues to exceed what truly the industry can easily deliver in this moment. And this is why you're seeing that earnings momentum in parts of the AI infrastructure complex that has been so strong. I mean, in the US, when you look at semiconductor earnings, they are doubling this year, record levels. I mean, some of the semiconductor companies are noting that demand, and I quote, because this is quite recent, extremely robust. And they're seeing that that visibility now extend for several years into the future. So that sustainability question, though, I do think is a very important one. It is the right one. How long does this CapEx cycle last? You know, who earns that attractive returns on that spending? And when do we see enough monetization to really justify that investment? And we are already seeing that tension in the capital markets. You're seeing, you know, U.S. AI-related names have issued over, you know, $250 billion in debt across various currencies this year. And that's including that nearly $200 billion from the five largest hyperscalers alone. And then you've had equity capital raises as well, you know, just in the last couple of months of over $100 billion in identified equity capital raise. And then, of course, you have the private, you have the vendor finance and other structures. And the point I'm making here is that the spending is large. It's still very well funded, and you know it's still pretty much very capital intense. And so we continue to believe that global AI capex can get to around $1 trillion next year, and so that's an over 20% growth on top of the 70% that we're expecting this year. And so we do think that, you know, near term, that earnings picture for the AI infrastructure remains very well supported, and with the hyperscalers continuing to spend. You're also seeing, Karen, what's important is, you know, enterprise adoption, that's broadening out. You're seeing new workloads, you know, such as agentic AI, physical AI, all of that is going to require more compute over time. And so we think that that will continue to support the demand for semiconductors, for foundry, for memory, the networking, the cooling, the power equipment, and really other parts of that enabling layer that we've been highlighting for some time. You know, in fact, you know, we had a piece out earlier this week where we talked about, you know, semiconductor equipment revenues alone, we think is going to grow roughly 30% compounded over the next 3 years. So the point is that this is a very durable structural growth, well supported. But at the same time, you know, we have to acknowledge that it's becoming more matured. It's becoming we're at that capital intensive phase of the cycle. And so some companies funded very large investment before we have seen any proven revenue pools, you know, fully developed. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that the opportunity is broken though, but I think, Karen, what it does mean is that the market is increasingly, distinguishing between those companies that have visible earnings. The pricing power is really important, the supply constraint, and those companies that still have monetization still further out. And so, you know, the net takeaway here is that we do remain positive on AI, but it should really be owned with discipline, you know, through actively managed, diversify exposure across the value chain. And that matters because we've seen volatility rise just in the last few weeks. We've seen, you know, massive move downward in the most traded part of the most crowded parts of the trade. And so we do think that it has to be managed in a disciplined way. And so, you know, right now we favor the picks and shovels still where, you know, you do have that earnings visibility, that momentum is strong. We're more selective in the mega cap platform layers where, you know, investors still want to see that clearer evidence of AI spending that translated into more durable revenues. And so we hope to learn more during this earnings season. And so what we're looking for, some signposts that we're watching is, you know, where is semiconductor memory pricing going? Where is cloud growth going? Where is CapEx guidance going? Where is power going? And I think more importantly, what will be able to sustain this spending is, you know, ultimately the evidence of AI monetization, which is coming through cloud, but we want to see more of that expanded.
Brilliant. Thanks, Nadia. And I think that's a good segue actually into Jason, because I know you've been writing recently, you know, not just about investing in AI, but the sort of the broader consequences of this revolution for the economy and for the different asset classes. So, you know, perhaps you could take us through some of the highlights in your thinking.
Well, sure, Karen. So, you know, Nadia, you know, just gave some numbers on the amount of investment that's taking place with, you know, AI. When we think about all the different ways in which AI is impacting the U.S. and the global economy, there's this investment story. There's this, you know, massive demand for energy. There's questions about the labor market, how that will be disrupted. There's questions about, or at least, you know, impacts from the consumer. You know, the stock market's done very well because of AI. That's created a wealth effect that's helped support at least consumer spending in the US. Questions about productivity. So a lot of things kind of come at you. What we tried to do in our report was you can create a framework to be able to assess all this, because if you just sort of overreact or react to every new data point, you don't have an ability to sort of contextualize. You can end up making sort of wrong conclusions about the overall impact. So in the report called the AI Economy, a Roadmap, we laid out a framework, you know, has three main kind of components. One is we just try to look at how is AI actually impacting the overall kind of growth rate of at least of the US economy, like sort of in real time, what is the impact? That's the first thing. The second part is like, what is the long-term potential growth as a result of AI? And this is primarily going to be the impact of productivity. How much more productive can the US economy and other economies be because of AI? And the third aspect of this framework is to think about the macro regime. And we define a regime as what is your growth environment? What is your inflation environment, especially relative to kind of long-term averages? Is it rising, accelerating? Because the macro regime ultimately impacts, the market performance. So we have this framework. The reason why we have this framework is that, you know, for kind of three main reasons. One is that it, you know, gives us a roadmap to sort of assess new information as it comes in. As I mentioned, a lot of areas where the economy is impacted, we want to sort of assess and kind of track it in real time. The second is that now AI is so significant that it's almost like a macro factor that's going to impact all asset classes. And it's not just sort of a line item in your portfolio. Like it's kind of cuts across the board. And then it's also the case that AI, because it impacts the macroeconomy so much, you know, it impacts the regime, and the regime can impact what different asset classes can do typically. So we think having a framework to think about the economy matters ultimately for the investment decisions. Now we're in the report, we kind of off really in some way ask more questions than we have good answers to. There's a lot of uncertainty of how this will all play out, but a few kind of high level conclusions or observations we make in the piece is that, like, this pace of change for AI is unprecedented. You can measure it in weeks or quarters or months versus kind of typically maybe years that bigger trends kind of play out. A second thing is that just in terms of the actual economic impact, our assessment is that roughly 50 basis points of U.S. growth this year, you could say, is entirely attributable to AI through both investment spending, but also kind of the swath effect of helping to support the consumer. So that's a significant sort of, you know, driver of a lot of the kind of the U.S. economic story this year. Another thing we kind of think about it, like, is sort of an AI flywheel. You know, Nadia touched on the fact that, you know, you got to get these productivity gains. That creates demand for compute, that creates demand for investment. It kind of can kind of flow. So as this sort of, you know, cycle proceeds, that can drive a lot of this macro, dynamic overall. And a couple other things, obviously a lot of focus on the labor market, the implications. The data would suggest that right now, the impact on the labor market is pretty minimal, but that's likely to grow over time. Same thing with productivity. The data doesn't indicate a lot of productivity impact right now, but it's also likely to kind of, you know, grow over time. And the final thing is, it is impacting policy, whether it's, you know, regulatory policy, but even Federal Reserve policy of setting interest rates. It's inflationary short term, longer term, perhaps it's less inflationary. So many ways in which we think about asset allocation, about the economy. AI is central to many of these aspects.
And thank you, Jason. I mean, we've heard on this call, you know, a lot of uncertainty in the geopolitical space, this huge revolution in AI with these wide-ranging consequences that you've just described, and, you know, broadening opportunities in equities. How are you thinking from an asset allocation perspective of bringing that all together, and where do you think investors should be sort of positioning right now in portfolios?
Well, if you think that we're now kind of operating in sort of an AI economy where AI is influencing everything, you really have to kind of think about then, how is AI, when you construct portfolios, how is every asset class being impacted? You know, what are different asset classes pricing for different outcomes and scenarios for AI, and how it will impact the economy, whether it's growth, inflation, policy, other factors? And then from an asset allocation or portfolio construction perspective, there are different ways to play AI. You know, people think of buying semiconductors, but as Nadia laid out, you know, sort of the picks and shovels, sort of the physical aspects, you know, in some ways might be the better way to think about this right now. So when we kind of go across asset classes, you kind of have to take this very holistic view of how AI is impacting it, not just sort of, you know, think about, you know, individual, you know, companies or opportunities. And if you don't, again, you sort of could kind of miss out. And whether this means for equities, obviously where within the equity story you want to be positioned, but also for other asset classes, enormous amount of, you know, money's been issued, you know, debt's been issued just to finance the build-out. You can see that sort of being an impact on, you know, credit, and sort of the relative opportunities within credit versus equities. Where do you want to be positioned? AI also has sort of as a macro story. You know, as I mentioned, it can impact inflation near term. It can impact the Fed and whether the Fed chooses to raise rates. We don't think they will, but it can impact short term and long term, the policy decisions. It's impacting capital flows globally. A lot of these investment opportunities are in the U.S., so investors are allocating more money, or they would have to allocate money to the U.S. Those capital flows also influence currencies, the U.S. dollar versus the euro, the pound, other major currencies. And this could continue for a long period of time. And even things like commodities, the build out for the AI infrastructure, the data centers, the energy demand, this is putting a demand on commodities. We view commodities as attractive. AI is sort of, part of that overall. So a few years ago, I think the way I would have thought of it is AI is maybe an allocation, like a line item in your financial statements, like you allocated to a handful of companies. It could have been the Mag 7 3 years ago. Now I think of AI as almost a vertical that cuts across all of your asset classes, and you have to understand what's the exposure, where's the best opportunities, are you getting kind of compensated for that? And you have to be sort of nimble because these things are changing very quickly and very fast.
Thanks, Jason. I think that's a fascinating, very differentiated take on AI and how people really need to, evolve the way that they're thinking because of this huge change taking place. We've got a few minutes left, so I'm going to get into some of the questions we've got coming in. I think the first one, perhaps for you, Jason, you are asking for overall conviction level on fixed income, and then specifically how you would compare high quality to high yield bonds in the current environment.
Well, for fixed income overall, and this is globally, we rate them as attractive. We've seen yields back up or like a rise, just over the past month. Part of this goes back to the higher oil prices, higher concerns about inflation, the possibility that, the Federal Reserve and other central banks will have to raise interest rates to combat that inflation. Ultimately, we don't think this inflation shock stemming from oil will kind of be this be significant pass-through or sort of second round effects that ultimately this inflation will come down. That the market is too aggressive in pricing, certainly in the US Fed rate hikes. Now the market has one full hike priced in by the end of the year. We ultimately think the Fed will stay on hold, and the next move is more likely to be a cut rather than hike, when we go to 2027. As that happens, yields are likely to fall, especially at the front of the curve. So when we think about opportunities, we like kind of higher quality fixed income, but sort of more shorter maturity that applies in the US, but also kind of applies in other regions in Europe, whether it's the UK or kind of across different Eurozone countries, under the idea that ultimately those front end rates are going to decline and sticking sort of a little bit with higher quality. Now, at the same time, we have a macro environment in the US and globally that is, relatively kind of benign. It's taken various headwinds and shocks over the past year, whether it's tariffs, whether it's high oil prices. And you're seeing global growth quite resilient. And in fact, signs that you could see like a bit of a cyclical kind of recovery globally. That's an environment where, when you think about where the yields are, that makes it, some parts of the credit markets kind of relatively attractive. High yield is one of them. We upgraded them to attractive overall, in part because high yield, less exposed to interest rate volatility, especially because it typically has shorter maturity, maybe 5 years or less versus, higher quality investment grade bonds. So less exposed to interest rates going higher, but also if interest rates go lower, you get that benefit of sort of, incremental carry. Similar story kind of for emerging market, high quality sovereign bonds, attractive incremental return that you can get or yield, but also kind of, relatively contained in terms of the fundamental risks overall. Having said that, the key message I would say is there's opportunities across fixed income, and a sort of a diversified approach at this point in time is, is probably the most critical thing. But still sticking a little more with higher quality, still sticking with a little bit more shorter interest rates because of the view that we have that rates are likely to go lower rather than higher at this point in time.
Thank you, Jason. I guess another question coming in as well. I mean, Nadia, I think, great overview on the breadth of opportunities on AI. I guess a question specifically on where you think people should be positioning in equities right now.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And Jason hit upon like the cyclical story, particularly and how that helped drove some of the upgrades in the bond market and in fixed income. And it's a similar thing also in equities. Of course, the structure story is still there and an anchor, but we are also leaning into the cyclical side as well. I mean, in particular, we in this cycle, we re-upgraded Europe, the Eurozone and European Bank because the earnings cycle is really gaining traction. We're seeing that improvement in manufacturing that I talked about earlier, but also loan growth is picking up. And then you still have the benefit of some of the structural spending that's really tied to AI electrification, defense and energy security that should broadly support earnings in Europe. So like that area, you know, outside the US also, I would highlight Asia, like we maintain that attractive view on Asia ex-Japan and Japan. I mean, really, Japan is continuing to benefit from that margin expansion story, the corporate reforms, the buyback, the AI exposure. And then I would also tack in their broader EM. And I think, you know, our attractive view there is really the earnings momentum has been quite strong. A lot of it has been driven by that AI story. Valuations are reasonable. But, you know, if we get some stabilization in oil prices and yield stabilization, you could really see that performance broaden out beyond the, you know, the AI heavy North Asia into the wider cyclical and domestic. So I think those are key things for equities. It's not the structural is there, but the cyclical is also picking up. And I think we're at a phase in the cycle that it's not just about whether you own equities, but it's really how you own them.
Brilliant. Thank you, Nadia. And I think that's a good point on which to close. I think that's all we have time for today. So yeah, thank you to you, Nadia, Till, and Jason for joining us. So yeah, a complex geopolitical environment, and we've got this AI revolution taking place, but as we've heard, plenty of opportunities across equities, fixed income, and beyond, and still a good environment to be putting money to work. Of course, if you'd like to discuss what some of these developments mean specifically for you and your portfolio, please reach out to your UBS advisor, and thank you once again for joining us.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.